Welcome to another episode of True Crime Time. I'm your host, Megan. I hope you all are well. I'm very excited about today's episode. If you have been with True Crime Time for a while, you will have noticed that there are not one, but two John Wayne Gacy episodes, as that is probably, to me, one of the most intriguing serial killer cases. But why am I excited today? I have a very special guest with me. Her name is Karen Conti. She has been a litigator and trial attorney for 37 years. She's handled many high-profile cases, including a First Amendment appellate court case before the Supreme Court and representing serial killer John Wayne Gacy in his final death row appeals. Karen is joining us today to talk about her new book, Killing Time with John Wayne Gacy, Defending America's Most Evil Serial Killer on Death Row, which I've had the pleasure of reading already. And I could not put it down. I really love this book. So, welcome, Karen.
Well, it's so nice to be here, Megan, and thank you for reading my book.
Oh, you're so welcome. Happy to do it. To start off, just to kind of start at the beginning, can you talk about how you came to represent Gacy?
Sure. Well, your listeners should know that Gacy was committing the crimes in the late 1970s. And at that time, I was in high school. So when he was arrested and he was convicted, I mean, he was the boogeyman for all the young kids growing up. So flash ahead 14 years. I'm now I've gone to college, I've gone to law school, and I've been a lawyer for just a few years. And my partner and I get the call that Gacy would like for us to go down and represent him, perhaps meet him first and represent him some civil matters that were pending. And we knew that he had his death date set. So we're thinking to ourselves, why would he be worried about money damages and money issues when he was set to be killed? But we were very curious. I'm a very curious person. Megan, you and I talked a little before the show. You've always been a serial killer, person. I have
Reader.
always done that my whole life. I was a Jack the Ripper. I grew up with all of those theories. And so I was just wanted to go down and meet him. I wanted to see what death row was like. I wanted to see what John Wayne Gacy was like. I wanted to see what it looked like to look evil in the eyes. So we took the trip down there and we met with John Wayne Gacy.
Wow. I would have done the same thing too if someone was like, "Hey, you have to go. You have to go." But you did want to actually represent him. Can you tell us why?
Well, so when we were talking about the civil matters, that they were just irrelevant. And Gacy was very he diverted your attention to things that he wanted to talk about. So we said to him at some point, listen, we'll represent you in this nonsense and we'll get it resolved. But what we want to do is we want to be on your death penalty team. He already had two really good death penalty lawyers. And I said, let us use our resources, let us use our talents, let us use our office staff, and let's help you try to save your life because we weren't trying to get him out of prison. We were just trying to stop the execution. And so that is how we came to be on his death row team.
Certainly, certainly. When you were kind of deciding, like when you decided, yes, we're going to take this case, we want to be on the death penalty s squad, I will say, for lack of a better term, did you think at the time that that was going to be received as unpopular? Like, what did you think about that part of it?
I was very naive at that time, and I naively thought that, listen, lawyers do this all the time. We represent people who are guilty, people are innocent, people are good, people are bad, people are likable, not likable. So I kind of thought everyone's going to get it, that everyone deserves a defense. But I was wrong, and the backlash from handling this case was horrific. Death threats, bomb threat, horrible letters, a lot of it directed toward me. I'm the only female on the death team. And I guess now that I look back with all the wisdom that I have now, having, been away from that for 30 years, I realize that that's what happens. When you get tagged with the evil acts of your client, people are angry. They're rightly angry at the Gacys of the world, taking boys and young men from this earth and torturing them. I get it. But their anger was directed toward the lawyers. And I didn't understand that that was going to happen to the extent it did.
I think that's understandable. I wouldn't have thought that as well, because even from the perspective reading this book, it was like, well, that's the job. right? Like you're reading, you're like, this is the job to defend this person. So I kind of was surprised by that as well. So that's definitely interesting. Can you talk a little bit about, I know you did just mention very briefly, like his crimes and just kind of his background.
Sure. Gacy was raised in a sort of a normal home back in the 1950s. His father, however, was abusive. He was an alcoholic. He would hit Gacy. He would call him effeminate names. Gacy was probably always gay or at least bisexual, and he just didn't fit into the mode of John Wayne, the macho cowboy actor who for whom he was named. And he didn't like hunting and fishing and going into sports activities. He'd rather be home with his mom, cooking and gardening. So his father was relentless in harming him. So he did grow up. He had some issues growing up, and he then became a successful contractor. In today's numbers, he was probably earning about $400,000 a year doing construction jobs. He was very industrious. He went to church every Sunday. He was married twice. He had two children. His wives loved him. He lived in a very nice community. He did charity work and volunteered to do a lot of different things and was actually politically connected. So he had this upstanding life and this moral life, but yet at night he was going out, finding young men and boys, bringing them back to his home and torturing them, raping them, killing them, and burying most of them underneath his house. There were 33 altogether, most of them under his house, a few in the nearby river.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot. He had a lot, an
It's a
interesting
lot.
life,
It
a full life.
was a it was a world record at the time, 33.
That's certainly a lot. So when you did go to meet him, he's on death row. So you did go to visit death row. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience, being on death row?
Yeah, so it's 6.5 hours south of Chicago, so you're on the same latitude as Memphis. So we're way down south on the Mississippi River, and we go in there. It's a horrible place, and you're not behind a plexiglass window like you normally would see in the movies. You're really locked in this bullpen with all of the people on death row who are visiting their ministers or their girlfriends or their lawyers, which I was not expecting. So all these people, and as a lawyer in Illinois, you kind of know who the people are who are on death row. You know what they look like, you know what they did. So you're saying to yourself, well, that guy, poisoned his whole family, or that guy eats body parts, or this guy does. So you're sitting there and you're meeting with this serial killer, the world record holder, but yet you're kind of looking around, watching your back, because these other killers are roaming free range around this room.
Yeah,
So
I
it
can
was pretty
imagine.
daunting.
I was gonna say, it's not only are you meeting with this person, but then you're kind of like hyper vigilant about your surroundings. So that had to be kind of a lot of emotions and things at the time.
Yeah, and while interestingly, I was never afraid of Gacy because I knew that his crimes were very organized and he was a predator. So he would plan out his murders, and I wasn't his type. So I never felt like he was going to pounce on me or do something. Plus, he needed me and he wanted to manipulate me. He wanted to, get me to do what he wanted me to do for him. I was a pawn in his life, which is how sociopaths are. But the other killers were not as organized and not as predatory. They were more reactionary. A lot of them were psychotic and medicated, and also having nothing left to lose. That was a bad combination.
Certainly, I can understand that. So it's interesting. So you said with him in particular, though, you weren't nervous in his presence, but because you kind of thought of him as a planner, right?
Yes, he wasn't, he just wasn't going to lose his stuff. He was going to. That wasn't the way he operated. He could live a normal life and did for the majority of his life, with the exception of these horrific things that he did. So he was able to compartmentalize, and I knew he was going to do that with me.
That makes a lot of sense. What was he like? I know you said he's kind of like regular. So what's kind of an interaction with him like?
Well, you wonder to yourself, like, how should I treat this guy? I know he did really horrible things, but I'm not going to sit there with my hands crossed and go, okay, hi, John Gacy, like Mr. Evil. You don't talk to people like that. And listen, when you're a lawyer, you've got to do your job. So I have to have a connection with people. And there are plenty of people whose actions I do not approve of, like men who beat their wives, people who, embezzle money from their churches, companies that manufactured asbestos. I represented all of those people, and I don't really like any of that stuff, right? Don't approve of it. But I have to have a relationship. And so Gacy and I had a cordial relationship. We would talk to him about the weather. I talked to him about he liked to cook when he was on the outside. We talked about that. We talked about gardening. We talked about the Cubs playing. We talked about all kinds of things. I talked about what his life was on death row. What did you do today? Who did you correspond with? What are your kids doing these days? You know, so I had these conversations with him. First of all, I was interested and kind of curious about his life. I was. And I also wanted that bond so that when we had to make decisions and we had to take action, I could get his cooperation because he was very oppositional and he was kind of argumentative, less so with me than with the other lawyers who are male. But I knew that I had to get him in a place where he trusted me, and that was the way to do it.
Okay, that definitely makes a lot of sense. So in this relationship that you kind of built with him, did you find that there were things about him that you did actually like? Were there pieces or like aspects of him, or was it just like you playing your part to get him to play along with what had to happen, you know?
I mean, there were parts of him that were very likable. I mean, I apologize to your listeners who are going to say, how can you like anyone who killed all these people? I've had people that I represented for much less than what Gacy did, who I liked a lot less than I liked John Gacy.
That's very interesting. Yeah.
He was intelligent. He was funny. He could be kind. Now he's a sociopath, so he probably doesn't mean any of this stuff. He knows what to say to kind of get you to like him. You knew that was going on when you're talking to him, but like, he was likable. There was nothing out of the ordinary where you'd say, I think the most unlikable part of him, he was kind of a know-it-all. He was kind of one of those guys who kind of knew everything, smartest guy in the room. But believe me, I've been around a lot of people like that, a lot of men in law firms, in politics, in my social life. So he wasn't the worst of the worst when it came to that.
Yeah. So you had some experience with that. So you know what was going on. So.
I think we all do.
Yeah, definitely. That's interesting. Okay. So your relationship, you're saying it was different with him than like the other lawyers involved. Do you think that's because you were female? Like, why do you think that was? And kind of what was that was different?
Yeah, I really do think it was because I was female. And you know what about Gacy is interesting. He really loved his mother. He had two sisters who he loved dearly. I became friends with one of his sisters over these past 30 years. So I got to know her, and she's a lovely person and a smart person. And he had children, and he liked women. He was softer with me. He was a little protective with me. He was a little gentlemanly with me. He'd stand up when I walked in the room, you know, and he was just nicer to me. But that allowed me to do my job in a way that probably was a little easier than with the other gentlemen on the team.
Yeah, no, that definitely tracks as well.
And which just goes to show you again, like, not that you're using your femininely wiles, but you know, sometimes the difference in gender can be an advantage in that I think women, you know, not always can be better listeners. You know, they can be more collaborative. And I think that I was that way with Gacy, and that really helped me do my job.
Yeah. That's awesome. So you did mention a little bit about his humor. Was that kind of always at the forefront? Did he lead with humor? Was that kind of his thing?
He did, especially with me, because I have a pretty good sense of humor. I always say I'm a serious lawyer with a serious sense of humor. And my father was a stand-up comic for, you know, the entire time we grew up. So I have been around comedy and comedians and analyzing what's humorous. And Gacy had a very good sense of humor. He was a good joke teller, but he was also a person who could just off the top of his head say something really, really funny. And in my book, I don't want to overanalyze things, but I did talk about humor and how Gacy used humor, I think probably in a way that benefited him in his quest to kill. And that is that when people are funny, you want to be around them. It's really an attractive part of a personality. And so I think he engaged people that way. And I also think that it deflected attention away from him when the police came calling and asking him, you know, where was this boy who was last seen with you? And, you know, he would invariably make up something and make a joke about it, whereas and that would deflect the attention away from his guilt. So humor was part of his personality, and I think it helped him do his job.
Absolutely. Yeah. I would definitely, I think that's very smart. It makes a lot of sense considering all of the things you've seen. It seems like he had a little bit of dark humor as well,
Yes,
some of the
very
jokes
dark.
he would make. Yes. I'm a person with very dark humor, so even there were times I was reading this that, again, it's Gacy, so you're like, I don't want to find this person funny, but I'm laughing out loud reading some of the things that happened.
Well, Megan, one of the things that I've been told, you know, by book agents and people is like, Karen, you really can't talk about his sense of humor. And I usually follow instructions from my professionals around me, but I will tell you this. I don't think anything's funny about what Gacy did. I mean, I wouldn't be a human being, you know, if I thought that. But if you're going to ask me what was Gacy like, how could I not say that? I would be remiss. I would not be telling you what his personality was like, because that's what you all want to know. What was he really like? That was a huge part of his personality. So I have to talk about it. And I also joked back with him, because that was a way that I dealt a little bit with some of the stress involved in doing what I was doing.
Absolutely. And there's that bond. Like, there's something you have to bond over. You're doing your job. And if you have similar senses of humor or big senses of humor, those kind of relationships definitely do form naturally. So that's understandable, I think. So we talked about kind of that end of the spectrum, but there was like a darker side to him. Many people have said he could be volatile and he could kind of like change on a dime, like his temper might flare or whatever. Did you experience that side of him?
There, I did not really, except for one episode, and I talk about it in my book. And I'm just going to leave it to the listeners and to read my book. But
Read the
there was a
book.
little bit of an, let's just say there was a little bit of an outburst. It wasn't directed to me, it was directed to my partner. And I don't know if that was a true outburst where he lost his temper as much as it was, I think he planned the outburst in order to dominate. And I think that he wanted to put my partner in his place, because my partner is a dominating person himself, kind of a big guy, kind of a egocentric guy. And I think Gacy planned that in order to kind of push him in his place. I don't think it was one of his outbursts, but when you read the horrific accounts of some of his torture and murder, some of the kids who escaped said you saw it come over his face. He would be one, you know, engaging and jovial, and then all of a sudden, like, his eyes literally
He would
got dark.
change.
And he would change. But you hear that a lot with serial killers.
You do. Well, it's
Yeah.
interesting. I was thinking about that because even I just watched recently, and it was so funny because I wasn't expecting to see you in the special I watched the other day, and there you were when I watched the Peacock special. What was it? Like Devil in
Devil in
Disguise.
Disguise.
Yes.
Very good. Very
And
good.
I heard your voice. I was like looking at my phone, and I was like, "What? Wait a minute. There's Karen Conti." But seeing him, because there's footage of him in that special. And he does look so normal, but like your other, he doesn't look like a serial killer. Like we have some that do and some that don't. Like your Ted Bundys don't necessarily. Everyone said he was handsome, whatever. But some of them, like Dahmer looked a little, you know, but Richard Kuklinski, for example, like from over by me, he was dead in the eyes all the time. That's what he looked like all
Yeah.
the time. Do you know what I mean? So that was kind of an interesting thing to watch him, watch Gacy and see just what a regular guy he seemed like. But to read those accounts like you're saying and how the change would kind of come over him, it just is very, it's chilling to kind of think about how people can just change like nothing, you know.
Yeah. And you know, and who else is capable of that? Who's around us, you know?
That's a very good point. You never know, you never know. So his in his initial trial, Gacy did lodge an insanity defense. This was not successful. Why not? Because many people would assume that if you're killing dozens of men and burying them in your crawl space, that would qualify you as quite insane. So why maybe would that have not been successful?
Well, the legal definition of insanity is really hard to meet. In Illinois and in most states, there's two parts. One is you have to prove that the defendant has a mental illness or affliction of some type. That was easy. We could prove that. But the second part is that you have to show that that affliction or mental illness prevented the defendant from knowing the difference between right and wrong and complying with the law. So once you start burying bodies, you obviously know that what you're doing is wrong, right? Otherwise, you just leave them in your yard. So for the even for the Dahmers of the world who disposed of body parts and hid them in refrigerators or whatever he did, they're never going to be insane because even though you think they're insane, right? So the insanity defense is really for people who are psychotic, who are walking around listening to voices and, you know, thinking they're seeing Jesus in front of them and that type of thing. So
Sure.
Gacy just didn't qualify.
That is an inter it's an interesting choice, kind of in retrospect, like knowing all that information. Like, why was that the avenue chosen? But I do
Well,
understand it was.
what
I
else
was
could you
gonna
do?
say it's difficult. It's
Yeah.
difficult because you have to find some kind of defense, and it's like, well, I guess we'll give this a shot because what else can you use? You know?
And maybe a jury member, you know, is going
Yeah.
to say what you just said. How can you not be crazy at doing this kind of stuff? I mean,
Yeah.
that's the definition of insanity, is it not?
You would
From a
think.
moral standpoint or from a normal standpoint, it is, but from a legal standpoint, it just isn't.
Certainly, that makes sense. By the time you were hired by Gacy, he had 14 years of appeals. So there's a very long appeals process on death row. What was left to appeal at that point, and what was kind of your strategy behind that?
Well, at that point, all the traditional appeals had been exhausted, and we were just really attacking the method of execution, the fact that executing, you know, in the way that it was done in Illinois is cruel and unusual. We had all kinds of really cerebral arguments to try to make, and you know, they didn't go anywhere, obviously. And you know, with Gacy, they weren't going to go anywhere because no judge was going to rule in our favor on any issue, even if we had a good one.
Right.
So, you know, you do what you have to do. You're zealously representing your client. If a person is going to be executed, you want to make sure that he got every single last argument made for on his behalf. And that's what we did.
Awesome. All right. Now, a theme in this book is you don't believe in the death penalty. And I'm sure a lot of people will find that interesting because even for Gacy, not even for Gacy, can you talk a little bit about that?
I just have always been against the death penalty. It just logically didn't make sense to me that, you know, you're killing is wrong and now what the government is going to kill. That offended me when I was 7 years old.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I have all my arguments and I really don't, I don't think the book is, I take a chapter and I do give you my arguments because I think I would be omitting a big part of why I did
Yeah.
this and why I took on this cause by not giving you my arguments. But I assume that most people do not agree with me because the death penalty is largely favored, a little bit less so today than back when I was representing Gacy. But you know, I just have always been against it, and even for Gacy. And you know, we had a situation where after Gacy was executed, in the 15 years afterwards, we had 12 men taken off death row, not because of technical arguments, but because of actual innocence, DNA, confessions by other people, et cetera. And we had 12 people executed. So we were doing it wrong 50% of the time.
Right.
And that's why our conservative Republican governor commuted all the sentences and put a moratorium on the death penalty because he said, I cannot in good conscience do this. And so we get it wrong. We got it, you know, Gacy was guilty. There's no question. But that next person down the line may not have been guilty, or he may have had incompetent counsel, or he may have been prosecuted due to racial disparities and things like that. So there's all kinds of reasons people end up on death row that have to do with things other than the egregiousness of their crimes. And Gacy didn't have any of those arguments, but some of the others do and did.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting as well because first of all, the chapter where you do talk about kind of like the statistics about the death penalty is very interesting. So even I think if you can read it with an open mind, you're going to learn something and it might give you pause if you're just like, yeah, whatever, fry them or whatever people say when they do that. It's very interesting, and that's something like Even like in school, when you take like criminal justice, they have you debate it and they have you learn those things to be educated to make those kind of arguments for people. But we did say, or we were just saying, Gacy had 14 years of appeals. So we're talking about people on death row having years and years of appeals. And even sometimes, despite the number of appeals they get, innocent people are still on death row, even throughout all of that. So it's definitely very interesting when you look into it more.
Well, and I give an example of one particular defendant where 12 people found him guilty, not only guilty, but that he doesn't deserve to live. Appellate court reverses, another 12 find guilty, doesn't have a reason to live, goes back, comes, so 36 people find that he's guilty, and there's no reason to get this guy to keep this guy alive. And it turns out somebody else is sitting in a prison cell confessing to the crime, and now there's DNA and everything tying him, the other guy, to the crime. So we get it wrong in death penalty cases more. Why? Because death penalty cases usually are egregious. Children, multiple murders, torture, sadistic crimes. And when you have those horrific facts and you got 12 people in the jury looking at that defendant, they say to themselves, if there's any possibility that that guy did it, I got to put him away. So even though reasonable doubt and all that, you're instructed, those jurors are afraid that they're going to let someone out who's a monster. And more mistakes are made in death penalty cases than in average cases.
That's an interesting point as well. So speaking of people being apprehended and so on, so in the book, you do express concern regarding Gacy not being apprehended sooner than he was. Do you think that's something that can be attributed to like the era? Like it's kind of like the early days of like not early days, but investigation and DNA, and that wasn't even like a thing at the time. Do you think it's that, or do you think maybe there's another reason?
I think that I'm going to answer it in another way. I think that if Gacy were Gacy right now, he'd be one and done or two and done because there's DNA, because he was a sex offender in Iowa before he started his crime spree. And there would have been a sex offender registry and a database that would have been connected, and there have been cameras everywhere. So this would have been, I don't think Gacy would have been as prolific. But you're right, it was a different time. Number one, we didn't really understand serial killers back then, really. And there were also all these incidents where the police kind of knew there were boys running out, screaming and yelling. And I think they kind of dismissed it as a gay thing. And, gay people were not treated very well back in the 70s. And I think the police kind of would throw up their hands and say, oh, that's that culture. Like, I don't really give a crap about it. I also think Gacy was really good at, deflecting. And I think he was connected with people who are in politics and who are the policemen. And I think that, we just didn't have the knowledge on what these people are capable of, because over and over again, the police would come to him and say, this boy was last seen going into your house applying for a job. John, what happened to him? I don't know. He's with probably a runaway. I don't know. This would happen over and over again. There was one kid who escaped with horrible injuries. He gets the police to arrest Gacy. The police drop the charges. Why? I don't know. And so over and over again, these things would happen. And, part of me says, gosh, was he connected in a way that someone was protecting him? I don't have any facts about that. Maybe we'll never know, but I do believe that Gacy would not have survived 33 if this were today.
I think that's true. I think that makes sense. Something you said in the book, you just reminded me when you were talking about the boys, because he says, like, he did initially like confess, right? But then he said, I never said any of that. That never happened. And then he talks about, he has this book, right? He has this book that's full of articles and photos and of all of these victims. And I was wondering if you know, because in the footage in the documentary that was just I just watched, like I said, The Devil in Disguise, he has a big book. Is that the same book? Do you know? It's
I'm
an
not sure.
enormous book.
Yeah, I'm not, I think it is, or he could have added to it. But what was interesting is when he was incarcerated, he hired somebody from the outside to do research on all the victims. And so they, this was before the internet. So this private investigator had to go to like newspaper offices and go through microfiche and copy things. And so they had like yearbook pictures and like little league pictures, and he were kind of color coded with tabs. And I was like, what is this, John? Why do you have this? He was like, oh, I wanted to figure out who all these victims were, so maybe I could figure out who actually killed them, which, is a load of, what. What it really was a scrapbook of his souvenirs.
It's something I've read before. Like I've read about this book, like this kind of like fabled book, because no one's ever seen it after that, right? After he
No.
was executed, it's just kind of up and vanished, which is probably for the best. But it is, when I've read about it, and then like I said, I believe if it's the one that I just saw the other day, it is like three dictionaries thick. Like it's very enormous and off-putting that you would have all these pictures, and he would even show like, this page is full of all the pictures of everyone, and he was like showing it. And it's like,
Proud of it, well,
that's
because all in all, he wouldn't say this to me, but he was proud of all of his crimes. He was a guy with no conscience here. He wanted to be the world record. He thought he was really good at being bad, and that was his claim to fame. Ugh, but that's the way people like that think.
Certainly, it's really something. That's all I can that's all I can say. It's really something. So you do have a theory that I was very intrigued by, that Gacy didn't commit all of these crimes. So in your opinion, how can this be true?
This is one of the things I'm most certain of about all the speculation that there is around Gacy, and that is that there were two young men who were living with Gacy during this last part of the crime spree, and they testified at trial that they dug the trenches in the crawl space. They claim they didn't know that Gacy was doing any of these crimes. They claim that they never put the bodies down there and they knew nothing about it. That's not believable. Gacy was portly. I don't see how he could have gotten dead weight down there to bury those boys. He needed help. I'm sure they helped him. My guess is that he recruited these two young men. He gave them money. He gave them drugs, gave them jobs, and they probably helped abduct. They probably helped bind them and torture them. And what was really interesting was Gacy showed us his business records, or actually, we got his business records, and they showed that he was out of town on numerous occasions when these boys and young men went missing. So even if you fudged a few days before and afterwards, it was clear Gacy wasn't in town. He had receipts and phone and records and everything to show he was out of town. So Gacy wasn't in town when these kids were abducted. The only people who could have done it were these two young men. I firmly believe that.
So just that, kind of just out of curiosity, because I know we don't know. I know we don't know for sure, but the ones that would have occurred when he was out of town, do you think he still like had knowledge of them? Or these were people that were like, well, he's doing it anyway, let's just like add some more, he'll never know, and just throw them in the crawl space. Just like speculating. I don't know. There's no way to know.
I never even thought of that question. Like, did Gacy come back from a trip and the kid said, "Hey, John, you'd be proud of me. I just did this." Oh, I don't know. I really, it's hard for me to know. I mean, there are people who speculate that Gacy allowed other people who were so inclined to dump bodies in his crawl space too. That could be another explanation,
That's
because at the
interesting.
time, there could have been some kind of sex ring that, like, for people who like this kind of stuff. I don't know. There's a lot of speculation.
Oh,
A
certainly.
lot of
There's
speculation.
always going to be
Yeah.
around this in particular. Well, it's interesting because even with what you're saying about, if other people were using it almost like as a dumping ground, that one quote he always said came to mind, like, the only thing I'm guilty of, what was it, is like running a
Cemetery without a
cemetery without a
license.
license.
Yeah.
Yes. So that's interesting from what you just said. If he was like, yeah, sure, why not? I already got a few, and you could just add if you want, very casual, like very weird.
I mean, a lot of people roll their eyes when you talk about this stuff, but when you talk about people who like to do bizarre things, like there's people who like to kill animals while they're having sex, okay? There's a whole group of those people. I mean, it's not just one or two. There are groups of them. So you find me something kinky and weird to do, there are people who do that as well.
How do they
And
find each other, though?
it was harder back then because we didn't have the internet, right?
Sheesh.
So, but I do think there were some underground sex rings going on, and you can read there was a book called Serial Killer's Apprentice, which is a very good book about Dean Corll, who also had two apprentices who helped him do the same thing that these two young men helped Gacy with, I believe. And there was a whole sex ring of young men and boys with that whole thing. So,
Wow.
you know, does it still go on? Maybe. I mean, you've got the Jeffrey Epstein kind of thing going on
Sure.
where, you know, you have somebody who's giving important people access to young girls and, you know, in exchange, getting favors. So, you know, I think that stuff will go on forever.
Yeah, I'm sure that's unfortunately true. Do you believe in this case that there were other victims?
Yes, I also think there were other victims. Gacy was out of town, as I said, during large portions of this killing spree. So he would be out of town for 3 weeks in rural Wisconsin and Florida. And why would he stop killing for 3 weeks while he's away? You know, especially because the areas where he traveled were largely places that were less occupied, less urban than where he lived. He lived in the suburbs, but there are people all over. And so, you know, you can, you know, the houses are close together and there are people all the time on the streets. So to me, it would be much easier to procure the boys, you know, do your thing and then bury them. And I hope that someday some podcaster sleuth will look at those business records, determine where he was when he was, and see if there can be a tie to if any young men and boys went missing in that area during that time span.
That would be very interesting. I'd be very interested to know, because it's almost like, you know, if you're visiting somewhere, I feel like because it's not your normal area, you do feel more kind of like emboldened to kind of act out of character, like people on vacation doing crazy things. Maybe that's like his vacation in his mind, where he's like, oh, I'm going to the bar, I'm doing whatever, you know, you never know. So
And people didn't know who he was. So, you know, they couldn't say, oh, I saw Gacy leaving with that kid. So, yeah, I don't know that we'll ever know that. And, you know, back in those days, too, you have to understand that when Gacy was apprehended, there was a call to say, like, hey, there's some victims that are unidentified. Is anyone, you know, related? And a lot of the parents didn't come forward right away because they didn't want to be known as, you know, having a gay son.
That's
Not
so
that all, not
unfortunate.
that his victims were gay, because they weren't all gay, but that was still a stigma back then, which is very sad.
Yeah. That's so unfortunate, definitely. We did touch on this very briefly before. I just want to get back a little bit to kind of maybe a little bit of like the psychology. So many serial killers have markers in their childhoods, things that are similar when we like profile them. So you got your head injuries and your arson and your abuse and your animal abuse and things like that. Were there things, I know we mentioned Gacy's father a little bit, were there things in his childhood that you believe contributed to his criminal behavior?
He didn't have any of the triad, that I think it's called the McDonald triad, which is the bedwetting, animal torture, and arson. I talked to his sister at length about this, because I said, are you sure? You know, and she said, no, he was kind to animals and didn't start fires. So he didn't have any of those. But the abuse by his father, he was sexually abused twice when he was young. And I think that his being raised in a very strict Catholic home was very much at odds with who he knew he was, which is homosexual or bisexual. I think he was shamed by his father. And interestingly, his father, when he beat him, would beat him in the basement. And some of the psychologists made much of the idea that Gacy would bury his victims, you know, underneath the house. So again, like, there are people who grew up in homes that were a lot worse than John Gacy and didn't do the horrible things that Gacy did. So I'm not saying that to excuse him, but you could use some of these things to explain what might have caused him to do this.
Absolutely. I've had that conversation, I can't tell you how many times, where it's like, many people grow up in abusive households, or things happen to them, and maybe they struggle in life with some issues, but they certainly don't go on to become serial killers or murderers of any kind. So it's definitely like, why do people do what they do kind of thing, you know?
There's so much written about this stuff, and it is fascinating. And I do think there's a dominance and control factor that Gacy had, where he somehow found himself enjoying in a sexual way the dominating of these kids. And, you know, the psychologist will tell you that is because he was powerless at home when he was a child, and he couldn't, you know, he couldn't stand up to his father when he was being abused. And so this was his way of turning the tides and dominating those children and then finding pleasure out of doing that.
Yeah. That's definitely something we find like commonly with a lot of things. That's kind of like my area. And like you said before, I'm like a serial killer person. My kind of area of like the most interest is kind of the psychology behind it. So it is like a thing you find with when they do the profiles on them. It's like abuse at home, and then they're kind of taking their power back, but in the most absolutely horrific way that anyone can imagine, unfortunately. And this is just one of those cases, unfortunately. So Gacy was ultimately executed almost 30 years ago. We're getting very close, in May of 1994. And you put in all this work. You met with him, you knew him, essentially you had this relationship. What were your feelings about it at that time?
Well, it was very confusing because, you know, to me, to say that he was my friend, he really wasn't my friend. When you're a sociopath, you don't have any true emotions. So he's kind of a shell of a person. But I had empathy for him. I knew his family. I knew his friends who loved him unconditionally. I watched them sob in saying goodbye to him. I had formed a relationship with him. I was trying to save his life. I took it very seriously that he was dying on my call. And it was confusing because I thought, when do you ever know that someone you know is going to die at a certain day at a certain time to the minute? And, you know, you want to call the authorities, but the authorities are the ones who are going to do this. So it was very complicated, and it was traumatic for me, actually. I didn't know that I was going to feel that, because I knew that he was going to be executed. I mean, I wasn't that naive that I was going to. I mean, I thought it could stall the execution a little bit, but you know, when I walked out of there, I was just traumatized for me. I was traumatized for his family. I felt responsible. I felt like the government did him wrong. I walked into a cheering crowd with hundreds of people lining the paths on a Monday night at midnight. And, you know, there's people like screaming and dressed as clowns. And I just thought, this is really disturbing.
It's a horror show.
I mean, even if you're the victim's families and you want it to happen, I respect that. I totally respect that is something that you want, because your loved one died. But I'm sure they didn't appreciate that kind of circus.
I can't imagine.
Disgusting.
So obviously I didn't experience this, but reading the book, I didn't expect to feel emotional. Like you said, you weren't expecting to feel kind of this emotion, but getting to that part of the book, and reading about this probably since I was 15, right? Where I'm like, I know the story, I know what happens, I know what he did, I know whatever. And then getting to the point in the book where we're talking about his last day and kind of what you're experiencing, like the complications, I was like, oh my gosh, I feel sad right now reading this, because it is putting yourself for anyone who's going to read this. I really do want anyone who's listening to read this book, but when you put yourself in your shoes, you can really understand the complicated emotions that come with that, like all of the things, all of the work and everything.
And there's one more layer to that, Megan, and that is, you look at a human being and you see him, he's a person who's breathing and he's talking and he's got something to offer at least somebody in this world. And he wasn't born evil. What happened to him? Like, you know, I'm not saying we let him out. That's not what I'm saying.
No,
but it who did something so bad to him that he had to live his life, you know, in a cell half the size of a parking lot spot. And we have to inject him with poison. We've got to kill him to protect society from him. I mean, how bad, you know, how bad, what happened to him? You know, what did the world do to him? And how can we prevent that? Like, because that's not the way things are supposed to go. And I do not believe he was born evil. I just don't, because I know his family and they're good people.
His sister does seem lovely. Like, she's been in lots of documentaries and things, and she seems like a sweet, normal is a relative term, I understand, but a great person. So it is heartbreaking also. Like,
who's also traumatized.
She's
How would you like to know that
traumatized.
your brother killed 33 young men and boys? She's felt guilt about that. She's like, could I have done something in my
No.
to with my family? Could I have? And then they executed her only brother. And she had to grieve on that. And she can't even be righteous about it because the victim's families, you know, are grieving in a different way. And it's just, you know, so there are layers of grief here.
Absolutely. It is tragic all the way around, like you said. What happened to him? How was he made into this, right? So that's another thing. And a lot of people, I don't know, I know people get in their emotions about people who do things like this, right? But it's like their families are all victims as well. They don't, for the most part, know that this is going on. They find out after the fact and they're as shocked as anyone. And also it's someone they knew closely. And it's like, how can this person have done these things, right? Like
Right.
It's traumatic
They're
for
even more
everyone.
shocked, actually.
I
They're
believe
the
it.
most shocked, right?
I believe it. I can't imagine. I've had this conversation many times with people. My sister, I have one sister only. We've talked about this before. I'm like, imagine if you just found out that all of a sudden, just like mom's yard was full of people that I murdered. Like, imagine like your whole world is turned upside down. So I do have a lot of empathy for those people as well, because they didn't do anything.
And remind me, Megan, not to plant tulips in your yard.
Don't do it. Only, what do they say? Only endangered plants, so you can't dig them up. I don't garden, period. So no one has to worry about my yard. But if you do see me outside, worry about that maybe, because I don't do that. But we touched on this before too. You did experience quite a bit of fallout throughout and after your representation of Gacy. I feel like I wanted to take this kind of in two parts. What did the people close to you feel about this? Like your friends and family, what was that kind of reaction like?
Well, my mother, who is kind of a disapproving person by nature, did not think it was a good career move. No, I mean, people around me were like, what are you doing? I mean, almost everyone was saying that. Judges didn't like it. Judges would pull me aside after court and bring me in chambers and say, what the hell are you doing with your career? Why are you doing this? You know, judges should know why I'm doing it, right? So no, neighbors were nasty. You know, there was a lot of fallout, but you know, once this whole process started, I really had no choice. And now that it was, and then once it was over, what was interesting is that there was this, I call it like a collective sigh of relief, where people in society are like, okay, he's dead now. We don't have to worry about him getting out or doing anything else again. Now we can ask you the question, Karen. What was he really like? Now I want to hear your story.
So they were just waiting. They were like,
And you know, because it's, you know, there's so much tension when there's this idea that he might live and people want him dead. And I think that when the time goes by, then this story is less threatening to people and less offensive.
So we talked about like personal and the public reaction. We talked about, like you said, like bomb threats and death threats and stuff. Was that happening on like a large scale, like this kind of public backlash that you were receiving?
Yeah, I mean, a bomb threat to me is pretty large scale when they had to evacuate like my tower, my bank tower
No.
in
Oh my
the downtown Chicago.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot of it was directed toward me. A lot of it was sexual in nature. A lot of it was bizarre. A lot of it is ongoing for years. I still get stuff from people. I can recognize their handwriting.
Still.
And after I did that Peacock thing, I had another a bunch of backlash. A lot of and more women than you would think. Also, I don't know if I go into this too much, but I did have a lot of prisoners who constantly contact me, you know, saying things like, you know what, Karen, I want you to represent me and we'll cut a deal, get me out of jail, and I'll point to the 16 bodies that I buried in Alabama, that kind of stuff. I'm like, oh, that would be a really good deal for the prosecutor.
That's a good deal. Yeah. I don't understand. I truly don't understand. Like, I understand the emotion. I understand people and their emotion, but it's like, if you just take a moment just to think about it, it's the job. It's the legal system. Everyone gets representation. I don't understand the backlash. Like, I do in a sense, but I don't, but because people can't look at it objectively at all, you know?
I think people, number one, think that I'm harming the victims' families directly. And I also think that there's something gender oriented. I think that a lot of people see a strong woman and they don't like that. And they need to bring me down. They need to cut me down because they don't like me doing a man's job. And if you look at the sociology studies about this kind of stuff, that's exactly what happens. Like in police departments, that's one of the places where women who are police officers get the most discrimination and bad conduct because they're doing this man's job, and a lot of men don't like seeing that happen.
That's very
Things are getting
interesting.
better, I think, in this world, but I think there's still some of that that goes on.
That's very interesting. Wow. Do you think that's there was some misconception that like you thought he was innocent? Do you think that played into it at all?
I think people who didn't listen to what I was saying or what we were filing might think that I was trying to get him out of prison. But Gacy told me, I do not want to get out of prison. He said I would not be safe out there. I think what he was saying to me is that he was glad he was caught because I think he was ramping up really bad. I think it was stressful. I don't think he was remorseful, but I think he wanted it to stop, and he knew that he was going to continue to do it. And I think he knew that if he ever got out by some fluke, that he would continue to do it.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. I didn't know that he was like wanting to not get out. That's interesting. That's very interesting, huh? So I feel like we just answered this question, but I'm going to ask anyway. It does seem that the negative public reaction was disproportionately focused on yourself, versus the other lawyers representing him at that time. Why do we think that is? You just said it, but just to be real clear for the listeners, why do we think it was disproportionately focused on you?
I think number one, I was the most vocal of the group in talking to the media. I was sort of designated as the person to talk, and the media gravitated toward me because I was the female and that I was, maybe a little easier on the eyes than the other dudes. I hope. And I hope so. Anyway, and then the other part of it is I think that, other than what we talked about, I think that maybe they thought I was the weak link because, oh, I can pick on Karen because she's a female. I also think that some of the anonymous things, it's sort of like texting these days. People text things they would never say to you in person just because they can.
They
I
sure
think it was a
do.
lot of that going on. So, but I found it now that I look back 30 years, I find it interesting, but it was a little intimidating when it was going on.
I can't imagine. I can't imagine the stress, especially when you said initially you were like a little bit naive about it, and then all of a sudden it's like a tsunami upon you. So that's definitely stressy. So what do you think, just kind of taking a sharp turn, what do you think is the future of the death penalty in the US?
I think that it is going to be abolished in some way sometime soon. And when I say soon, maybe in the next 20 or 30 years. It has fallen out of favor. It has waxed and waned in public popularity. And when it's not popular, states stop doing it because it's very expensive to get the death penalty for a defendant. There's a lot of appeals that are very expensive, and the actual execution and the death row monitoring is very, very expensive. So it's cheaper not to have it. Really, and it, people don't understand that, but look at the stats. I encourage you guys to look up your own, Google it, and see how much more expensive it is. And that money can be directed in better places. But I think it's fallen out of favor. It's the lowest it's been in a really long time, maybe in all of American history. And I do think our younger generation is just not as inclined to this kind of thing. I think that we have a more sensitive younger generation. They're sensitive to all these social issues more than I think in the past. And I think that we're going to see those young people stand up against it. And it's going to fall out of favor to the point where we're just not going to have it.
Okay, I like that. I like that very much. Maybe not in Texas, but hopefully everywhere else.
Those will be the last ones. Florida and Texas, they're going to hold
Yeah,
on. They're going to
fair.
hold on to the death penalty like they hold on to the steer's horns.
That's a good visual, and that makes a lot of sense. So as far as I know, we kind of focused, we're talking about Gacy, we're kind of talking about like the legal aspect. As far as as the victims go and the victims' families, have you ever spoken with any of them?
I have not. I did reach out to two families and I sent them letters because I thought if they want to be heard in my book, I would want to give them a platform, but they were sent back. And I didn't really expect they wanted to be part of my book. But I understand that. And you know, one of the things I talk about in my book, Megan, is that I've represented victims over and over again. I represent victims of domestic violence like on a daily basis. I talk about this case where a little girl was sexually abused by a very prominent guy in the Chicago suburbs, and the prosecution wouldn't prosecute because the girl was young, although she was adamant. I mean, she knew exactly what he did and why it was wrong. And so I was hired by the family to actually secure the prosecution, to put pressure on the prosecutor to bring those charges. So I did I care if the guy went to jail? No, that was my goal. Put him in
Right,
jail.
of course.
Punish him so he can't do it again. So listen, I zealously advocate for my client. And if it's a victim's family, I'm all for that. And I can't consider that when I'm doing what I'm doing. I can't consider by my representing Gacy, am I hurting the victims' families?
Right.
You know, I just can't think that way. Do I feel for them?
Of
Oh my gosh.
course.
I mean, I
Yeah.
talk in my book about this recurring nightmare that I have of this last boy who was the reason that Gacy was finally apprehended. And
Right.
I'll let you read my book, listeners. But that haunts me more than anything. And it
Yeah.
still does, you know, that this beautiful boy who would be my age today, you know,
Oh, yeah.
was horribly, you know, killed by Gacy. And
Yeah.
so yes, the victims have rights. I like victims' rights,
Yeah.
but I can only represent one side of the baseball team at any given
Of
time.
course, that makes total sense. It's like you almost have to like compartmentalize it in a sense that you're like, this is the job I have to do right now. And do I feel for this? And is it awful what happened? Like, yes, but this is the job. This is the task at hand. This is what I have to
And
do.
even more importantly, I should probably have said is that maybe this doesn't apply in Gacy's case, but if I represent my client zealously and he didn't do it, let's just say he didn't do it or didn't do all of them or whatever, then someone else is out there walking free.
Right.
So I feel like if I do my job, and I can't do justice, but if I do my job and the police does their job and the prosecution does their job and the judge, everyone does the job, then we get justice and we get the right person and we put the right person away.
Yeah.
So, you know, I feel like I'm an important part of the whole system.
Yeah,
And I'm not
absolutely.
saying I've helped the victims, but I hope that I can, because if you truly are affected by crime, we want the right person in jail.
Absolutely. That's a great point. That's a great point. Like we said, you haven't spoken with any of the victims. Is there a message you would want them to have from you, if any, that you would want them just to know or anything?
I just, my heart goes out to you. You
Yeah.
know, I don't know how you recover from something like this. If it happened to me or my loved ones, you know, I would feel the righteous rage that you
Yeah.
feel. And, you know, I don't even ask you not to blame me. If you want to blame me, you can blame me. I'll take whatever emotion you have, because I know what I had to do. And if I rubbed salt in wounds by saying or doing anything, I apologize. And if Gacy's execution gave you 1 ounce of comfort, I'm very happy about that.
Wow. That's definitely very powerful, I think. And it's hard because it's like this isn't even it's not so long ago in the scheme of things. Like we talk about true crime, we talk about Jack the Ripper. People can talk about that, they make jokes about it, but there's still people who have survived, families of survivors
Sure.
alive. You know what I mean? It's not like it's 100 years ago. This is still a recent case, so
No,
I
it's still
definitely think
raw in
that's
Chicago. It's still, there are people in rooms that I go to where I talk and they said, well, my son escaped, you know, this day, that my
Oh
son
my
knew the
gosh.
victim. And so, yeah, it's still
Yeah.
raw in Chicago.
Wow. Understandably. We have, I don't know if you've heard much about our Long Island serial killer over
Oh,
here.
I know
So
all
that's,
about.
yeah, so do we. That's about 20 minutes from my house. Yes. So it is still that rawness when it occurs in your community. You feel the just the ripples, the ongoing effect is just it doesn't stop, you know, so
And
that's
there are a lot
understandable.
of A lot of parallels, and I've talked about this on the media, a lot of parallels between Rex and John Gacy.
Really? I'm gonna
Yeah,
have
I
to
mean,
look a
if
little more
he
into
was
that. Yeah.
architect versus construction guy,
Right.
married with kids, lived in an urban near an urban area, had a house, sex workers to some extent. So yeah, a lot of parallels. And I'll be interested to see if this defendant actually committed murders outside of the New York area and places where he had homes and vacationed. And I know their authorities are looking into that now.
Absolutely, absolutely they are. That's been our mystery over here for quite some time. Long Island, I know, I'm not sure, like I've never been to Chicago, I'm not sure, but it's a big island, but it's small town feel. Everyone knows everyone's business. Everyone
Yes.
knows someone's connected to anyone. So it's kind of similar also, like you're saying, your experience when you talk with people and they say, my son escaped this day. We all
Yeah.
kind of have a story about this over here. So I definitely understand that. So I guess kind of my last official question for you is, how did taking on this case change your life and your career? I guess we could do like a two-parter or both, whatever.
You would think that it would have plunged me into the abyss of lawyers, but it had the exact opposite effect. Almost immediately after Gacy was executed, O.J. Simpson took his drive in a Bronco and was accused of killing his former wife and her friend. And so CNN and MSNBC and Fox News all called me to say, Karen, we've seen you in the press talking about Gacy. Will you talk about the O.J. Simpson case? So I became a legal analyst along with a lot of people like Nancy Grace and Greta Van Susteren. I never became as famous and well known as them, but I did a lot of that. I did it locally in Chicago and nationally. And so I was given a radio show in Chicago with my partner. We hosted radio shows for 30 years. Even the dean of my law school came to Chicago and offered me a professorship to teach the death penalty. I handled one case and I lost it, and I now have become an academic professor. So, and even clients, they like the fact that I represented Gacy. They think I'm tough. They think, hey, if you represented that scumball, look what you're going to do for me because I'm a nice person. So it has become a calling card for me. And you would never think that being associated with an evil monster of a serial killer would be good for someone's career. But that's the way it works in the law. You see, everyone associated with O.J. Simpson did well afterwards. People who represent bad people like Alan Dershowitz always gets the calls to represent the tough cases. So I guess that's Gacy's legacy to me, is that by being associated with him, I somehow am viewed as a better lawyer, which is not true, but I'll take it.
All right, sure. One of the themes that I really appreciated from this book, and this is something like I appreciate as a human, as a female, like I love any kind of book or media I can consume where there is a powerful woman. That's a thing that I look for. I love that. So, but for this, it's fighting for a cause you believe in, knowing something is going to be very difficult, but doing it anyway because you believe in it. That takes real integrity. I think there's something we can all take from that, honestly. So that was one of my takeaways as well. And that's one of the reasons I really did love this book. None of you listeners are ever going to hear me stop talking about how much I love this book, but
Thank you. I
oh, you're
appreciate that.
welcome.
And I hope that is a good message that, if you're curious, be curious. And if you want to take something on, take it on, even if it's tough, and do a good job and be prepared and do it with dignity. And when it's done, you're going to be more resilient. You're going to be more confident. And you're going to know really who you are. You're going to know who your friends are. You're going to know where you're going because you know that you followed your own roadmap. And that's freedom to me, to know where you want to go and just do it anyway.
That's so powerful. I really love that. I really do think there's so many lessons that we can learn and inspiration we can take from people following their paths and listening to themselves. Wow, I really appreciated that. But so I just go ahead.
I appreciate your interview. You did a nice
Oh,
job
well,
asking
thank
me all the good questions, and I could see
you.
that you did read my book, and
I
I
did.
appreciate that.
I did read it. I was telling everyone. I already started telling everyone about your books even before this. So I'm very happy to have read it. I do just want to give you the opportunity. Do you have any final thoughts? Anything you want to add? Anything like that?
No, I just appreciate everyone listening. I hope you enjoy my book. I think you will find that it has the Gacy tone in it, that it has the stuff that'll draw you serial killer crazy people like Megan and myself.
Like us.
But it also will have a nice message for you, and I think it will be uplifting. And even young people past a certain age, that they're not going to be triggered by some of the bad stuff in the book. But I think it will be empowering, especially for women or people who might want to be in law school, young lawyers, people who want to take on causes, and also for people who might want to get a little bit of humor out of it, because I do think there's some humor in the book, even though the topic itself is not very humorous.
Absolutely. I totally agree. So I just want to let you guys know again, Karen's book is called Killing Time with John Wayne Gacy, Defending America's Most Evil Serial Killer on Death Row. It is available now. And I already said it. I'm going to say it again. I cannot recommend it highly enough. If you've read every Gacy book like me, it's a must read. Even if you haven't, just read it anyway. I don't care. I am going to link it on all of the True Crime Time socials just to make it easy for you guys to find. And Karen, I just want to thank you so much for your time. It really has been a pleasure speaking with you. I appreciate you
Megan,
talking to me.
I hope our paths cross again.
Me too.
Okay.
So for you guys, you listeners, I just want to let you know, as usual, you have been listening to True Crime Time, and please rate, review, and subscribe. And we'll just see you next time. Bye.